Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we have Dr. Charles Binkley. He's a well-renowned hepatobiliary surgeon and medical ethicist. So, here you go. I think you're going to like it.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
So now that you're back, we can do our normal intro.
I'm very sorry, everyone. I blame a Vanagon.
A Vanagon?
Yeah, exactly.
What's that?
Yeah.
It's those VW campers.
There was a van that you blamed before, and like, right. Now I'm also blaming a van.
It's like, don't take the van. Oh, crap. I took the van again. Yeah, exactly. That was total accident. We rented a van again, and it could only go 40 miles an hour, and you need to stop every 5.5 minutes for gas. It was just not like the best thing to do when you're trying to maybe get back and do a podcast, for instance.
Really? What is a van again? That's a type
those
of van?
Those VW campers that are like sort of classic old school.
Of a hazard with the 40 mile
it was
an hour
a hazard
max.
For every reason.
I mean, like, the could you go on the freeway with it? Or
we went on the freeway on the way there, it was okay, and the way back again with all the bacon, I think we went 20 miles slower per hour. It was not smart.
Yeah, well, at least you're live and the podcast can live on.
Yes. Boy. Thank you guys for covering. You did very well. I'm very sorry. Dennis Lowe was wonderful. He didn't need me.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about it. I probably would have been mad, but he's like such a positive dude that it's just hard to be mad around
him.
Oh,
yeah, exactly. I really appreciate your love of Dennis because it helped you diminish your hate for me.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It really did help.
They balanced each other out.
That's the reality.
So how are you guys doing?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good myself.
Joe likes when I go first.
I know. I was just...
Now he's taking over. Do you notice he went before you because you were gone? Now he goes.
There was hesitation you heard in my voice, and you just boom.
Well, I just figured you forgot what we were talking about again.
In Joe's words, you've been obsoleted.
What? Yeah, I didn't understand that from last time. Why did you say the bad use of the word obsoleted?
I don't think obsoleted is an actual word.
We were talking about artificial intelligence, and you said...
Obsolescence.
Ooh, this is nice.
Whoa. And you said, I don't think doctors will become obsoleted.
Obsolete is what I should have said, is what you're saying.
That is the whole point of the story. You got it.
Yeah. Anyways, go on. You were saying something.
No, I've been great. Playing a lot of music lately. Finally got done with a bunch of crap from work, so I'm working normal hours now. That's good.
I will also add this. In sort of response to last week's episode, talking about having to do things outside of medicine, outside of work, doing things that are just for you.
Like renting a van again.
Exactly. We played music this last Friday. We'll give a little plug to Lennon Studios because they're always so nice.
Oh, yeah.
It's this great studio here in the city, and we played there, and that was really fun. We got to do that. We haven't got to do that for a while. Whose phone was that?
Joe's. It's on vibrate.
Lizzie's.
Yeah, right. This is Joe being like, I swear it's on vibrate. Anyway, doing the podcast is also, and Dennis pointed that out, you know, that doing things like this fuels your creative, you know, side of your brain, in addition to actually learning about medicine and also learning about medicine in terms of culture, like what's important to our patients, not just our textbooks and, you know, our New England Journal of Medicine, whatever, but this is also things that are important to people outside of medicine. So
yeah,
uses that part of the brain, which I enjoy.
Anything you want to talk about in particular before we go to our guest?
Yes. I was thinking at work the other day because something happened that was not exactly according to routine, according to plan. How much, and this is a question for you, Joe, as a patient, and I've been a patient as well, but as a patient, do you feel like you want to know everything that happens? You know, if you go in, you get a colonoscopy, you come out, do you want to know, you know, the question really is conceptual. for patients, all patients, do they need to know every hiccup, every screw
up? No. yes and no. So yeah. That's a tough question.
The question is, what do patients want to know and what do patients need to know?
What they need to know, I think, really only is how anything in the surgery affects their health. If it's someone dropping an F-bomb, or if it's something where even a mistake is made, but it has no, you know, risk of safety, then I would say it's not necessary. But if there is something that went wrong,
right,
and the patient is going to get hurt from it, the doctor should tell them. But I know there's lawsuits, and so there might be a pressure not to even say anything. That's a good question.
There's a distinction between going wrong, and the word we use at work is M&M, morbidity and mortality. Was there a morbidity? Was there a bad outcome that's going to impact your life, or things that didn't go according to routine? For instance, I'll do a colonoscopy or a procedure and the scope will break, and then I need to switch the camera to start over. That adds 20, 30, an hour to the procedure, and the patient wakes up, they're fine. There was nothing bad that happened, or an anesthesia.
No long-lasting problems have occurred as far as you and your medical opinion can gather.
Right, but you probably gave a little bit more medicine than you would have. The procedure took a little bit more time. Maybe their ride came and was annoyed. You know, you don't know that stuff.
Yeah.
And an anesthesiologist maybe breaks off a piece of plastic in the trachea. You go get it out. And again, do you tell the patient when they wake up? You know, that this is the question. Mm. And, you know, for us in colonoscopy, upper endoscopy, routinely, we're using sedation. And there are times that we over sedate and we need to reverse the effects of the sedation. And this doesn't sound like a big deal, but for us, we do it so rarely, it's frightening. You know, when a patient's not breathing and you have to reverse it, do you need to tell the patient that happened? You know, again, need versus want. I don't know the answer to that. And
tough call, because you could, if I give the wrong answer, somebody could take advantage of it. It's so gray. So,
well, that's a thing, right?
I mean, like the trachea example, or something fell apart. Yeah, that's an adverse event in my mind.
Even but if they wake up and there's no consequence.
No, but they need to know, because there could have been something left.
Why not tell them then?
There may have been something left behind. The patient should know. So if there's some symptoms, they should look for.
But that's the thing, is what I'm saying is there's nothing left behind. The patient wakes up, you know, again, something happens.
She's saying no harm, no foul.
Okay.
And you're saying it's probably important.
Yeah, that's why it's a tough argument. I mean, what I say, it's gray. But I would lean to what Kaveh's saying, I guess, and that is no harm, no foul. But even that is not specific enough, I don't think.
Well, I don't know about this. I
don't know either.
I do think for most things, it's important to tell them. Just because I think mostly it's probably on my conscience. You know what I mean?
Then tell them.
Like,
if it's on the conscience, I think you got to tell them.
But I agree. Sometimes I don't know if you're doing someone a favor, because if there really is no problem and you really believe there is no long-term problem, nothing can occur from that, you might be giving them a little bit cause for paranoia.
Well, that's the thing, right? Some patients, before you start a procedure, when you're consenting them, telling about the risks, benefits of the procedure, of the sedation, ask a million questions. And then afterwards, you're like, this guy would probably want to know. And some ask zero questions.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, is this your own decision? Is this your intuition, you know, your emotional IQ, if you will, to make the decision after to tell them? Or because this is out of my routine, do I tell them? But for them, none of this is routine. Do you know what I mean?
Let me ask you a question, Lizzie.
Yes.
If you got off a flight across the country or across the ocean to Europe, and the pilot, you had a chance to talk to the pilot afterwards, would you prefer the pilot say, just so you know, there was this weird moment when we were like,
where we almost
died. 3 hours out over the ocean, where the plane got a little shaky,
just wouldn't go down.
But we got here fine, no problem, you're fine.
I do not want to know that.
Yeah.
I do not.
I got the answer to this. The reality is you can't, there isn't a one fair answer. It actually depends.
The answer is that there is
patient.
No answer.
It depends on the type patient. Of patient you're dealing with, and the doctor has to make a subjective judgment call. It's just like in management at companies, where you want to be fair to every employee and treat every employee the same way, but I assure you that does not work. Some employees, it's beneficial to tell them more stuff about what they're doing wrong. Others, you have to word things a different way or approach things. So people are all different. So I think it is a subjective judgment on the doctor's part, but there is not an exact line I don't think you can draw that everyone will agree on.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And again, there are these tiny hiccups that happen that for me doesn't even matter at all. And then there are some patients who might want that information.
Right.
Anyway, I think there's no answer. And I do think that every circumstance, my assumption is, and we can probably agree, that more disclosure is better, Because the worst case scenario is the patient finds out afterwards, maybe a nurse, the clerk checking them out, you know, says something, and then you're caught in a
More is better usually, but you could freak out a patient unnecessarily, like Kaveh's point too.
Yeah.
And just one final thought.
I do not want to know if my plane almost crashed.
Right. Yeah. And just one final thought. I don't want people listening to be worried. Complications during procedures are thankfully pretty rare.
Yeah.
And if there's, and we're talking about things that have no consequence. If there was a complication of any consequence, then of course your doctor is going to have to, should and have to tell you that.
Right. And the thing is that these things are so rare, whether there's a bad outcome or not, that we don't have a protocol. And this is exactly why we're talking about it. Because when patients say, what will you do if my intestine tears during your procedure? And I said, every case is, you know, I tell them more detailed answers, but at the end, I always say every case is so different because it's so rare. We don't have our protocol. So it's very interesting. Thank you, Joe, for your opinion.
Great question.
It is.
I don't think we have an answer out of all this talking, but good points.
Are you saying that what we just said was
irrelevant? No, we didn't really give it an exact,
this is life.
Line.
This is medicine. Man. It's black. Medicine, it's gray. Sure. It's not black and white.
Totally.
One last thing before I think we move on, I want to sort of plug, is for people sending in questions and emails. So again, the number is 408-444-6623, and the email is hopquestions@gmail.com. I want to sort of make it clear, if you guys have a specific question about something that is not GI, that's okay, because we either know it or we'll find someone who does, and we'll get the answer for you guys. So
exactly. The subject of the email does not need to be butt stuff.
Right. Although, speaking of which, we are starting to accumulate some of those good butt stuff stories. So if you're a doctor, medical practitioner of some sort, and you have a good body cavity story, let us know.
That's a good one. Body cavity.
Yeah, we're still thinking of a good title for that segment. All right. So we're going to step away. We'll come back in just a little bit with our guest, Dr. Charles Binkley. Full disclosure, we recorded the first part of this interview about 2 months ago. Due to some technical difficulties, we lost the second portion of that interview. We were told once that no great podcast survives without losing a couple of episodes, and hopefully this is the only one for us.
But other podcasts don't have Joe.
That's right. So we were really grateful that he came back to do the second portion of his interview today.
We'd like to welcome back Dr. Charles Binkley, a hepatobiliary surgeon and chair of the Medical Ethics Committee at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco. He went to Georgetown University Medical School and trained for surgery residency at University of Michigan, where he specialized in GI and hepatobiliary surgery. He also went to seminary school, and he's published and presented topics in both fields of surgery and ethics. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lizzie. It's good to be here. Good to see everybody. Kaveh, Joe, thanks for having me back.
A couple month ordeal, so we apologize, and we're very grateful for your return because we've had some technical difficulties and issues with scheduling, which we just all blame Joe. It's just easier that way.
Yeah,
but it's the truth. And we really appreciate you coming back and giving us your time again. We're very, very grateful.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
And will you tell us a little bit what ethics means to you and why it's important for medical people to be involved in ethics?
Absolutely. There's the truth that comes in medicine and science, and then there's also the art of medicine and science, and that's really, I think, the intersection of ethics. Sometimes randomized controlled trials or research can tell us what to do, but the question is it the right thing to do? And that's really where the art of medicine and the philosophy and the ethics comes into play. My own interest in ethics started back when I was in seminary. I went into seminary at St. Meinrad right out of high school. And there I majored in Latin and Greek, but also took a lot of philosophy and then took a specific course in bioethics from a Catholic perspective, and really got very engaged in the idea of these ethical principles And also taking them beyond even the church's teaching to think about what it would be like to be a doctor in those situations and having to deal with people within an ethical framework.
So can you maybe tell us a little bit about what a typical ethics consult would be? So if the committee's consult on something, what is it?
Oh, it's really fascinating. It can be throughout the range of the life spectrum, and also can deal with some of our colleagues can come to us and do come to us with issues of conscience. As we started our transgender program, there were questions about providers who had moral dilemmas around providing or participating in transgender surgery. There are, at the beginning of the life spectrum, there are questions about candidacy for fertility treatments and questions about, you know, neonates. And then toward the end of the life spectrum, there's always questions about, you know, sustaining, life-sustaining treatments and their appropriateness and about terminating care. So we really see consults from throughout the life spectrum. And they're not always life and death issues, but it's any source of moral distress. And we've, you know, entertained all sorts of different consults.
So I wanted to talk to you about sort of your views and to help our listeners and Joe kind of distinguish a couple of words. But specifically in California, the End of Life Option Act was passed and enacted almost exactly a year ago, June 2016, by Governor Jerry Brown. And I want to know sort of your experience with it at work and to help us just get, you know, some definitions down, something we touched upon last time, the difference between euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide specifically.
Sure. I think one of the important things to understand about any legislation that allows for physician-assisted suicide is really what it says and what it does. So essentially in every state, there's a law against assisting someone with his or her suicide. So it's, you would be criminally accountable if you assisted someone in their attempt, successful or not, to commit suicide. So really what it does is it exempts, under very specific situations, a very specific group of people from criminal prosecution.
Right, which is what Kevorkian was known for being prosecuted.
He was prosecuted because it really wasn't physician-assisted suicide. He wasn't. So self-administration is the real key here. Mm-hmm. So physician-assisted suicide or physician-assisted death really requires the patient to self-administer. So the physician is really just the one who makes sure that all of the criteria are met. A second opinion or a consultant comes in, confirms the diagnosis and the prognosis. If there's any potential mental health issues that might be confounding mm-hmm. the capacity of the patient, then a consultant is called in from the mental health arena. But the patient has to be able to self-administer. The physician doesn't administer the medication. And that's the real difference between physician-assisted death and euthanasia, where euthanasia is a passive process. Someone, a physician, some other instrument, some other person passively administers an agent to the patient to allow them to die. Now, people will say, well, what about diseases like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, where patients oftentimes don't have the physical ability to self-administer. And the law had rather discriminate against those people and say, well, you can't avail yourself of the law if you can't self-administer, rather than making the law too broad.
Mm. You just have to start off probably more cautious than not.
It's always better in a situation like this to be more narrow than not.
Yeah. But you could make the argument that ethically speaking, the patients who might need it the most are those people who are so sick or are so affected by their disease that they can't even administer a medication to themselves.
Great point. I was thinking the exact
right.
same
so
thing.
So there are workarounds to this. A patient has to be able to swallow. So the patient doesn't necessarily have to be able to prepare the medication. It involves taking a large number of capsules and opening them up and then mixing them with about 4 ounces of fluid, all the patient has to be able to do is to ingest it him or herself. Yep. Or if he or she has a feeding tube, to be able to somehow put it into the feeding tube him or herself.
You'd like to think that this conversation and the prescription would happen maybe before it gets to the point where you can't move like an ALS, Lou Gehrig's, but you know, that's requires a lot of foresight, and this is obviously a brand new law. So hopefully, again, part of palliative care and ethics is hopefully introducing this far before you get to that, you know, extreme point.
And I actually gave a talk to an ALS conference about the End of Life Option Act. And there are a number of assist devices that would allow a patient with ALS to administer the medication, even if they've lost their ability to move. So there are voice-activated feeding systems, so they could potentially still maintain that control. And it was amazing to see the assist devices available for patients with ALS, where early on in their diagnosis, they'll actually read lots and lots of books on tape, and so they're able to take those words and still be able to have a conversation in their own voice as the disease progresses. It's it's really quite amazing, the technology.
What kind of feedback are you getting from physicians regarding this, physicians that are doing this?
So most physicians, I haven't really been in a situation where someone has been actively opposed to it. There's always three layers. One is, what is your cognitive opinion of it? Do you agree or disagree? The other is this something that you yourself would avail yourself of? And then the third is this something that you would be willing to assist a patient with? And there are many physicians who cognitively agree with it and believe that it should be allowed, but really aren't comfortable prescribing the medication or going through the process with a patient.
It's like conscientious objection as well.
And that dissonance is fine. You can have the opinion that, for instance, on other issues such as, you know, abortion, you may well believe that a woman has the right
to choose. But be the doctor who performs the procedure.
But not really be willing to be the doctor to perform it. Or not really thinking that this is something that you would do yourself.
Right.
So that's okay.
Yeah.
We had a similar discussion with Pratima Gupta, who's an abortion provider.
Right.
And we discussed that exact sort of thing. It's a big step for someone to make.
It's a huge step to agree versus doing. You know, it's, you know, we all want to fight a cause, but getting out there and doing it or performing a procedure is a big difference. One thing, what are the statistics about the ratio between the prescriptions and the use?
A large number of patients who receive the medications, who go through the process and receive the medications, actually will never administer them. And that's fine. Again, that gives patients the ability to choose. Some of them will die before they have the opportunity to administer them. Some will choose not to. But some patients just want to have that control. They just want the opportunity to administer if their symptoms become unmanageable, if they feel like they're ready to die and the biological process hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So a large number of patients will receive the medications, and we actually have a system for the family to return the medications after the patient dies if they don't use them, because it's secobarbital,
right,
and you don't want a large quantity of secobarbital
sitting around.
So.
No. So a large majority, I think I'd read somewhere it was like 60% or something
60%,
like that.
60%.
Yeah. Wow. No, it's very interesting. And we have, and is ethics committee involved, or you're just involved because
of
your
patient?
It's really
palliative care that's involved. Palliative care largely is involved. Each medical center has a person or a group of people who sort of spearhead the program. At least that's been the policy within TPMG.
Yeah.
And so the ethics committee has only really been involved if there's been an ethical issue around it. We were involved early on in implementing it by having a forum for providers to come to discuss the ethical aspects of it, the pros and cons.
Yeah.
You know, we really maintain a very neutral stance as a group on it. And because it's really, it's a very individual decision, both for patients and for providers.
There is something that Lizzie and I wanted to do while we had a medical ethics expert here. And I don't know, is this going to be our new segment, Lizzie?
Yes, every single time we have a medical ethicist on, we will be doing rapid-fire ethical questions. It's a new game show.
Every time we have a medical ethics expert on. Yeah. So here's how it's going to work, basically. We're going to shoot a bunch of questions at you. Yes or no answers. You have one pass. One maybe? Can we give them one maybe?
I don't know. We're just going to keep talking and adding rules to the game.
Yeah, what's all the rules? I don't get it.
We're making this up as we go along, Joe. I don't know. Anyways, but we do have a lot of questions to go over. Lizzie, you want to get started?
I do.
Are we going to start a clock?
Yeah. Okay, ready?
Joe, time this.
Just kidding. You don't need a clock.
Okay.
Can you date a colleague?
Yes.
That's correct. No,
is that a doctor-specific question, or is that a surgeon?
That's less ethics and more sort of human resources.
Right.
Yeah, but yes, you can date a colleague.
But it's not my expertise.
It's transparency is probably the most important thing.
Yeah.
And I've dated a colleague.
Oh yeah.
Before.
Do tell. Just kidding.
Oh, I think I should probably edit that part out.
We can edit.
Well, it might have been at a different time when you weren't working in the hospital.
Maybe it was at a time a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly. What about this? Can you, as an attending, date a trainee or someone who's technically beneath you?
Yes.
Really? Actually, I'm a little surprised about that.
I think you can. I think you have to be very transparent in it. I know instances where it has worked, but I think the key is complete transparency, both with each other and also with colleagues, and most importantly, with superiors.
Because everyone's adults, right? Because I remember people dated an attending and a resident when I was a resident, and in the end, they got married. So everyone's like, oh, it's okay. So if they've broken up, it wouldn't be okay. But since they got married, it is okay. That's very arbitrary.
But it is true, though. What if you do break up and your attending is the person that has to grade you and assign you an evaluation?
I think you have to talk about that in advance. And I think you have to recuse yourself.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
I think it's probably not a great idea to do it while somebody's on your service.
Right.
If it happens, if you start to develop that attraction while they're on your service or while they're your direct subordinate, you should probably delay the experience or you should recuse yourself in that setting.
Yeah.
I think that it keeps it cleaner that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even beyond the drama of a breakup, I'm thinking just the favoritism issue and also other employees assuming favoritism, even if it doesn't even
yeah.
That's
exist.
Right. There's some things that you really never want to be questioned about, and that's probably one of them. It's hard, even if it's an unfair question or an unfair scrutiny,
sure.
There are probably some things that are better left unscrutinized.
Yeah.
Well said. All right, next.
Can you date a patient?
That's a no. There's actually a formal process by which you have to break off the doctor-patient relationship if you start to develop an attraction or if you think you want to initiate a romantic, a mutual romantic relationship. The board, each board, state board, has very specific guidelines for how that's done.
I'd like that you have like an official answer. I thought this was just being like, no, that sounds wrong and inappropriate.
Right.
You're like, no.
It's very, very discouraged.
Yeah.
Right.
But there is a very formal process that you have to go through. And I suspect our medical group also has a policy on it that would be very similar.
Surprised a little bit by that. I would think there'd be more risk in general with colleagues or someone reporting to someone being worse than having a patient situation where you're dating the patient. What's the risk?
It's really the patient-physician relationship is inherently unequal.
Privacy and whatnot.
Privacy. There are all sorts of difficult layers to that.
I see so many lawsuits coming out of that sort of thing. That just seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
Lawsuits and also the situation in which you meet a patient is an inherently unequal relationship. It's just set up to be that. You know, I use a lot of airplane analogies.
We do too.
Yeah.
And so patients will say to me, have you ever experienced this? Have you ever had a nasogastric tube, or have you ever had a drain in? And I always point out that, you know, I'm not a passenger. I'm the pilot. Mm-hmm. And although I haven't personally had those things, I've managed lots of people with them. And I want them to trust me to be compassionate, you know, toward their situation. But also, my goal is to land them safely at their destination.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that analogy in particular because it shows that you and the patient are on the same plane. You're going to the same place.
We're going to the same place. I also talk to patients about it's not as important to get into the air. But the really important thing is knowing that you can land safely at your destination.
Yeah.
So, for instance, the goal is not necessarily to get to surgery if you're sure that the operation, or if you have relative confidence that the operation's not going to be successful, but rather to know that you're set up for a successful operation and a successful outcome.
Mm. And you're saying the patient, the doctor, inherently is a different role, a different sort of power, because when you meet them, the patient's supposed to tell everything and the doctor doesn't need to reveal anything.
Absolutely. There's an inherent vulnerability in being a patient.
Yeah. Interesting.
That the doctor doesn't really share.
It's like clergy and, you know, their parishioners, right?
Right.
I mean, it's the same concept.
Right. You know, there are all sorts of those. And so I think if you think a romantic relationship is going to start, or if you're at all contemplating that, certainly, you know, going through the legal process and the ethical framework, but it's really best avoided, I think.
Yeah.
What about the family of a patient? Say, like, one of the son or the daughter come in to an appointment, and they, or someone you've been taking care of for a long time, then they ask you out.
Yeah, I think that also sort of has its set of difficulties. Mm-hmm. I think you would really want to dissolve the doctor-patient relationship with the family member first before initiating something with someone else or a member of that family.
What about dating a person named Patient?
I think that's just fine.
Come on now.
Patience, that sounds like a southern southern name.
Patience.
Iris.
Yeah.
So another thing we talked about before was gifts from patients, and we sort of...
Kaveh's still thinking about the cookies that somebody gave him 2 months ago.
So we sort of came to the conclusion that taking money from a patient's obviously a problem. I think that's pretty apparent to everyone. Like,
right,
you can't do that. And we're talking about, like, people who bring in, like, a New Year's gift for, like, Chinese New Year's, for example,
right,
in a nice red envelope. You can't accept that. But what about other things like cookies?
Yeah, I think that...
It always gets back to the cookies.
Back to the cookies?
I think that common sense really is the most important thing here. Every health system, every physician's group is going to have a set of rules. Typically, there's a minimum or maximum value that you can accept. Certainly, the AMA in each of the professional societies has its set of regulations. What I always try to do, if a patient were to bring me cookies, I would try to share them with the team so that it's a gift to everyone.
Right.
And I would invite the patient not just to give them to me, but to give them to my staff.
Yeah.
So that it's
that's the best all-round way to do it, I would think.
I think it's certainly monetary gifts or very expensive gifts. I think you'd have to be a little circumspect about.
But why is it okay to share with the staff? Because in the end, the whole concept is the patient garnering favor and advantage. So them giving everyone cookies or money or a gift or whatever does make people like that patient more or think about that patient differently, or the whole concept of being indebted. So sharing is wonderful, but it's not about the patient giving you, the doctor, a gift. It's about trying to get good favor from it.
I think it's in proportion, though. I think a cookie is very unlikely to have that profound of an effect.
Yeah.
Whereas if they had given you
ticket to the basketball game,
$1,000.
Yeah. You know. No, I'm just saying that sharing the wealth from a patient is getting...
Well, I mean, technically, you shouldn't be accepting a gift from a patient to garner goodwill. It should be as appreciation.
An act of appreciation.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I mean, and we all know, you're right, like, common sense ultimately is the right thing to do. But there's a right way to think about it.
Well, it's interesting. My father was in the hospital last year, and I told my sister, he was in the intensive care unit, and I said, stop every morning, on the way to the hospital and get
donuts
or baked goods.
Yeah. Super smart.
And drop them off in the nurse's lounge.
100%.
Just to show your appreciation.
Yeah.
And it makes a huge difference for people to know that you appreciate them.
Right.
And we're not expecting the standard of care to be different, but really we want to let them know that we appreciate what they're doing.
So in the end, if you're going to see Charles Binkley as your doctor, bring doggy treats for Jake.
You know, I've actually had patients do that.
Yeah.
Jake is the great equalizer in a lot of my patient relationships. Mm-hmm. I like to show pictures of him. It humanizes me. I don't have children, so he's the closest thing that I have.
He's a big German shepherd.
He's a big German shepherd. He's a beautiful boy. And people love hearing stories about him. Many of my patients will contact me on the anniversary of their operation.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, especially a Whipple, they'll contact me on the first year anniversary and say, I was thinking about you. I remember this day. And I almost all of them will say, and say hello to Jake. Aww. Or give Jake a pet for me.
Yeah. So,
that's wow. Very cute. Yeah.
That must feel really good.
It does. It's really very nice.
So one other question along this game show lines is, what are your thoughts? I think I know that there are laws about it, but about recording office visits or procedures. The context is in 2013, there was a case. I mean, I'm sure there are many cases, but I remember Kaveh and I were working together and we talked a lot about it because it was specifically GI related, where a patient went in for a colonoscopy and
accidentally,
what he meant to do was record the post-procedural, post-op instructions, because a lot of people don't remember. And that's 100% true, that people don't remember. But he accidentally recorded the whole thing and then sued the anesthesiologist and the gastroenterologist doing the colonoscopy, and he won. And in the end, it was, I think, illegal for him to do it.
But tell him why he won, what he recorded, actually.
There's so many quotes. It's like colonoscopies are typically 20, 30-minute procedures. It's like all the stuff that was recorded and said, I think that they have 45, 50. It's like they spent the entire procedure ripping on this guy. One quote is this. After 5 minutes of talking to him pre-op, I wanted to punch you in the face and man you up a little bit. These are the things. I mean, I've never said anything like this.
I think the important thing here is not about two-party consent to recording, but to always be respectful of your patients, regardless of whether they're awake or asleep.
Exactly. I think it was illegal for him to record, but the jury said that was so offensive. We're giving him money, quote unquote, just to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Right.
So recording, I'm not the lawyer in the family. My husband is, but I think that California requires two-party consent for a recorded conversation to be admissible, with the exception being if the second party is a police officer or a public
with a warrant.
Yes, that's like correct. That. I'm the lawyer in this group, and I will second that.
Yeah, and not all states have the two party.
No, Virginia specifically is one party consent.
One party consent.
Right.
Yeah. So not all states have the one versus the two party consent. I believe California has a two party consent. And I think we have a policy at TPMG about patients recording conversations.
That they need to ask or they don't do it, or both.
I think that it's allowed to do it, but I think they should ask. I think that's just a courtesy, honestly.
Yeah.
If I see a patient going to record without us talking about it in advance, I ask them to pause and let's have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm. Has it happened to you before? Does it
to get recorded? I have many of my visits get recorded, and I appreciate that. But I don't appreciate if it's done in a covert fashion, because it really erodes some aspect of the relationship. So I'll ask them to pause, and then I'll just say, you know, I think we should all, you know, give consent to being recorded. Some of my colleagues don't allow it, and I think that's within an individual's purview to say, I'd rather not be recorded. Yeah. You can take notes. I try to ask patients, if they want to take notes, to have someone there to be the scribe.
Yeah.
But really, I want to be able to dialogue with them in a meaningful way. Because a lot of my conversations with patients with pancreatic cancer and liver cancer are value-based. And it's figuring out what their values are and what they place as high priority. I saw a patient you know, this week who gave me four things that the patient valued in life. And we spent time figuring out what was the right operation to allow the patient to have those four things for as long as possible. I really appreciate those types of value-based discussions.
Yeah. What I do also, if patients seem worried and they're writing notes, and I do, I email all the time. I write after visit summaries of paperwork that patients can leave the office with. And if they start writing, I'll say, I'll write everything down for you. Anything that you're worried about, I'll email you. You know, I'm very accessible, which is the truth. I said, maybe it takes at most 24 hours for me to write back to an email, but I will write you back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also try to point people toward good resources online. So for instance, there's cancer.net from the American Society of Clinical Oncologists, which is a great resource.
Yeah.
The Pancreatic Cancer Action Network has great patient materials that they send me, and I can give them the patients to take with them. And I basically say, this is going to recapitulate everything that we talked about, so you don't have to worry about writing it down. And I'll show them. They have a diagram of a Whipple, which is an excellent illustration. And so I'll go through that. So.
Well, you actually, we did review it last month or 2 months ago. Can you just tell us quickly, or for Joe and our viewers, for not doctors, what Whipple is? And
Sure. The Whipple is usually for pancreatic head cancers or ampullary tumors or distal common bile duct cancers. But it involves removing the distal portion, the lower portion of the stomach, the gallbladder, the bile duct, the first part of the small intestine, the duodenum up to the proximal jejunum, and also the head of the pancreas. And then you reconstruct everything so that the pancreas continues to drain, the bile duct will drain, and the stomach functions. So it takes, you know, 5 to 7 hours. Sometimes it involves vascular resections and reconstructions.
This is the deal maker.
Child's play.
Piece of cake. This is the deal maker or breaker, I think, for surgeons. Like when you're a med student and you like stand in or help or retract on your first Whipple, you either leave feeling, I need to do this, or you leave being like, I cannot be a surgeon. I was sweating. My hands were cramping from retracting. I'm like, this is bull. I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
No offense.
I saw a Whipple at the beginning. I think I may have mentioned this when we talked before. I saw a Whipple early in my third year, my surgery residency. And I just thought it was amazing technically. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. But I also saw the surgeon not being very kind or compassionate toward the patient.
Yeah.
And I really thought, I believe I can do both. I think I can be good to the patients, take good care of them, but also perform this technically challenging operation in a way that's, you know, satisfying and accomplishes its goals.
Thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely.
It's been fun.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I've really, really enjoyed this and have great
respect. I think we got it done.
Great.
Yes.
Hey, thank you
so much.
Thank
you, Charles.
All right. And that's our show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, if you have any emails, hopquestions@gmail.com, or call and leave us a voicemail, 408-444-6623. Thank you to everyone who reviewed and starred our podcast on iTunes. Please continue to do that. Apparently that sort of thing helps us. And thank you to Nadeem Abubaker for producing, and see you guys soon.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.